Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation and the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians, on the web at chcf.org.
This is Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly look at the issues that matter to the residents of the San Joaquin Valley.
Hello, I'm Juanita Stevenson, and welcome to Valley Edition. On our program today, the controversy over chocolate milk included in school menus, how Fresno Unified and Producers Dairy came up with a winning formula. Also on our program, we'll hear how scientists are working to restore the Delta and how California's Proposition 63 is causing controversy 8 years after it was approved by voters. We'll also talk with local photographer Joel Pickford about its new book and upcoming exhibit about the Valley's Hmong community. But first, flavored milk was a staple in school breakfast and lunch programs until the controversy over chocolate milk erupted last year. The milk may have been packed with calcium, but it was also full of sugar. In an effort to make school meals healthier, many school districts decided to remove chocolate milk from the menu altogether. Fresno Unified, the Valley's largest school district, opted for another choice. The saying goes, milk does a body good. Despite that, too few of us really drink the white stuff. That includes adults and kids.
I don't like that much milk, like white milk. I don't like that much.
In an effort to get more kids to benefit from the nutrients milk offers, many school districts, including Fresno Unified, served up flavored milk, both chocolate and strawberry. So along with their daily intake of vitamin A, calcium, and potassium, students were also getting sugar, a lot of sugar, about 4 additional teaspoons in an 8-ounce serving of chocolate milk.
Well, we began in the fall of 2010 learning more about the chocolate milk issue and the added sugars in chocolate milk.
Jose Alvarado, Food Services Director with Fresno Unified, says the district had been working with UC Cooperative Extension to provide healthier foods to its students. With the Valley having one of the highest childhood obesity rates in the state, schools were under pressure to make changes in their menus, and flavored milk was a target.
So we started doing research in terms of what's in our milk.
Alvarado says the district began working with its vendor, Producers Dairy, to find ways to make their milk healthier. They first removed the high fructose corn syrup from their flavored milk.
That's a big change for a large manufacturer. You know, they have to have it reformulated, send it back east to have it taste tested. And then they brought us some samples to make sure it still tastes good.
Alvarado says the kids, who were probably the best taste testers, didn't notice the change. But removing the corn syrup wouldn't be enough. By then, the controversy over flavored milk in schools was heating up. Fresno Unified did remove strawberry milk from its menu, saying it had no nutritional value. Many kids didn't seem to miss it.
Okay, guys, next 2 tables.
I like the chocolate one. I don't like strawberry.
They do like the chocolate milk. Few even mentioned white milk. Sarah Boss with the UC Cal Fresh Education Program says the agency wanted to find out just how many of Fresno Unified students had even tried white milk.
So we did a tasting in the classroom of white milk paired with whole grain Cheerios. And a surprising amount of the students reported that they had never tried white milk before. They had never actually tasted it. Many of the students said that they don't drink any milk at home, and so their only milk exposure was at school, and they had only tried chocolate milk.
Armed with that information, Fresno Unified thought long and hard before eliminating what is the only source of milk for many of its students.
When at all possible, we want kids to choose white milk because it has no added sugar to it. But in a real world where kids are used to drinking chocolate milk, it's important to consider all of the different options that they have and keep them consuming this important food group.
Instead of eliminating chocolate milk altogether, the district and producers' dairy worked on making a healthier version of the flavored milk. All agree it was a huge undertaking on the part of producers.
It's not as simple like you just flip the switch and stop adding this much sugar. And no, it's a big undertaking. There were a lot of people involved.
Richie Shahadi, director of sales and marketing for producers, says it was a long process. Producers looked at what other companies were doing and worked with its chocolate supplier to come up with just the right mix.
We tasted a lot of chocolate milk from different places, and ultimately we wanted to come up with something that the kids like, because if the kids don't like it, they're not going to drink it, and if they don't drink it, then they're not getting that nutrition from milk.
For producers and the school district, it was a process that started in 2011 with the elimination of high-fructose corn syrup from their flavored milk. And by the end of that school year, producers had come up with what it hoped was a winning formula for chocolate milk.
A lot of people think that chocolate milk is the enemy, and in fact, it's really that sugar. People were unhappy with the amount of sugar in chocolate milk. And so basically what we were able to do is come up with a solution that was the best of both worlds.
The fat-free chocolate milk introduced to students last January had a total of 120 calories, 10 calories less than the 1% white milk, and contained 19 grams of sugar, just 3/4 teaspoon more than the white milk. Fresno Unified's Jose Alvarado says district-wide students are consuming a lot less sugar.
The analysis that we've done, we're estimating about 200,000 pounds of less sugar per year only in our milk.
Fresno Unified says not all health professionals agree with their decision to keep chocolate milk on the menu, but all those involved in the process of coming up with a healthier version believe it is a good compromise.
If kids aren't getting milk, they're not getting the nutrition and they're not getting that balance of their diet that they need.
Producers provides the new reformulated chocolate milk to over 140 institutions throughout the valley, all benefiting from chocolate milk with a lot less sugar. We're told it adds up to about 1 million pounds less of sugar when you add it up for all those institutions. We have more of this conversation with Sarah Boss with the UC Cooperative Extension. And we'll continue our conversation with Sarah Boss. She is with the UC CalFresh Education Program. Thanks a lot, Sarah, for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
First of all, you know, we looked at this whole controversy surrounding chocolate milk, and some schools continue to provide chocolate milk, even though it's been reformulated. Other districts have dropped it altogether. But when you look at it, what is important about making sure young people get the nutrients from milk?
Well, calcium, of course, is the first thing that we think about when we encourage children to drink milk, and adults as well, because, of course, growing children need the calcium to be able to build their bone structure, and then adults need calcium to be able to maintain that so that they don't develop osteoporosis. And then also milk is a wonderful source of protein for children, which is also needed for them to grow appropriately. And, you know, white milk without the sugar is the best choice. It's the first choice in terms of nutrition because we don't want to have a lot of extra sugar. At times there are kids that don't drink white milk, and so they want chocolate milk. And we need to think carefully about what options that we make available, and, you know, health experts don't agree as to whether or not making chocolate is the best choice available, whether or not it's the best choice or not for students, because we don't want them to miss out on the calcium and the protein.
Now, you work closely with the district in working to improve the nutrition in its foods that it offers students, and you did a study with students involving milk. What did you find?
Well, what we did was to increase the exposure that students had to white milk, we offered a tasting. Through our UC CalFresh Nutrition Education Program, we do tastings of healthy foods every month with classes that are participating. And so in the month of September this last year, a year ago this month, we worked with classes throughout the district, and we collected information from them about a tasting that they had that was 1% white milk. We wondered whether or not students had ever actually tried it before, whether or not they had tried it in an environment where they would have a positive experience with it. So we offered it with kind of a multigrain Cheerios, and 196 classes gave us information back about what that experience looked like. So it was preschool all the way up through eighth grade classes, although there were only a few in middle school. And surprisingly, 13% of the students reported that they had never seen white milk before. They may have seen chocolate milk in the past. I'm sure they had because they'd been at school, but they'd never seen white milk is what they'd said. And then 16% of them reported that they had never tried white milk before. So even if they had seen it, they had never tried it. And through the process of tasting, 96% of the students tried it that day. 93% of them said that they were willing to have it at school again. 92% said that they were willing to have it at home, and 87% said that they were willing to ask for it at home. So this just really shows that, you know, students, we make a lot of assumptions about what they have tried and what they haven't tried, and what they're willing to try again or even ask for. So there's a lot of room for education and for experiential education in particular that can open a lot of doors to healthy foods for students. And we work with parents as well to let them know that there's lots of opportunity for increasing the healthy foods that are around that dinner table and the breakfast table.
You know, there has been a huge effort to really educate students about healthy foods. And it seems to me with that study you did, even though many of them have not tried it, once exposed to it, they would drink it.
Yeah, there's a lot of evidence to show that that's true. And so I think that it just takes some effort and some education on the part of schools and community education programs like ours and parents to continue to offer it, because many times new foods are difficult for children. And parents are sometimes not quite as successful as third-party individuals coming in to classrooms. But I want to encourage parents not to give up. We have the opportunity to offer new foods to kids and to give them the opportunity to try it. And they may not try it the first, fourth, or even tenth time, but eventually as the food becomes familiar, research shows that children will adopt new eating habits if it's continually offered to them.
Now, Fresno Unified is just not involved in the effort to offer a more healthier version of chocolate milk. They have a committee, and you all continually work to look at making healthy changes to the menu.
That's right. The School Meals Committee, which is part of a coordinated school health approach in the district, is led by Jose Alvarado, who is the food service director, and several community organizations gather together, as well as other people from food service, and we talk about what's on the menu. We talk about ways to increase participation, and this group was able to get some grant funding from Action for Healthy Kids, and last year and this year worked on making some improvements to participation in breakfast. So some of the things that we implemented were adding what's called a grab-and-go cart on high school campuses. And what that is it's a remote location away from the cafeteria, but in a high traffic area where the students usually come in the morning, so maybe right inside the front gate. And it's a cart with an electronic POS system, so they're able to track which student had a meal, which is important for their, you know, their accounting purposes. And so students swipe their ID card, go through, pick up the items for their breakfast, and away they go, having had a breakfast that morning when many of those students wouldn't eat breakfast at all.
So those are different ways you're looking at to try to improve the participation in the breakfast program at schools, or get more children or students to participate in breakfast, because right now I think you only have like a 34% of the students who are participating in the breakfast or eating breakfast at school. Have you found out reasons why not more students are doing that?
Well, we're in the process right now of doing more assessment to really get to the bottom of that. But we have a lot of ideas. We get a lot of story versions of things. And so, you know, students sometimes say, well, I don't like the item on the breakfast menu, or I don't have enough time to eat, or on some sites it's free and other sites you pay for the breakfast. So they may say, well, I don't want to pay for breakfast. Some students, especially older students, say that they just don't like eating breakfast that early in the day. So we're going to pilot at a couple of schools what's called second chance breakfast, where breakfast is offered, say, between second and third period, so that students who don't, their stomach doesn't quite wake up as early, they have an opportunity to eat later. And so as we get to the bottom of exactly why students are not participating in the program, which is oftentimes free at many of the school sites in Fresno Unified, they qualify for all of the student body to eat for free. As we get those answers, then we're able to address in innovative ways those issues and barriers that the students have and get more students in the classroom ready to learn because they've had breakfast and they don't think about their stomach growling.
And that is probably the important point in all of this, is that breakfast is still considered just a very important meal for young people.
It's true. It's very common, especially in elementary schools, but it's really true throughout, that students complain that they are hungry and so they're not able to concentrate. You have nursing visits with students who have tummy aches and it's because they didn't have breakfast. And I know that the schools are trying to respond to this in the best possible way and many times make provisions for those students because they want them to be able to do well in the classroom. But if we can be proactive and come up with solutions so that all the students have access to a healthy breakfast and it's taken care of right away, then we can avoid a lot of those things that disrupt the day later on.
And I think what we take away from this is that this is an ongoing process for Fresno Unified and other school districts in our area, and that they are continually working to improve the nutrition content in the meals they provide for students.
Yes, it is an ongoing process and a complicated one. When you're serving thousands and thousands of meals and it's on a pretty small budget under the National School Lunch Program, it can be pretty tough. I was having a conversation with my son this morning, and he was talking about the school meals and the kinds of things that he would like to see. And when I told him how many meals they're preparing and how little money they're doing it with, he was just shocked. And he immediately knew that some of the suggestions that he was making were not realistic. So it is a process. It's kind of a puzzle to figure it all out, but we're making great strides. And I'm sure that with food service and the school meals committee and support from the community, we're going to be able to continually make progress and improve what we're serving the students.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Sarah Boss with the UC CalFresh Education Program. Thanks for joining us. I'm Juanita Stevenson, and you are listening to Valley Edition. When we come back, we'll hear about a new study that is looking at the past in order to find solutions to help the environment of the Sacramento-San Joaquin River Delta, and about a famous vocal group from San Francisco that is bringing its 35th anniversary tour to Fresno. That's all coming up on Valley Edition.
Support for Valley Edition comes from Kaiser Permanente Fresno and Cahuilla Delta Medical Center.
You're listening to a rebroadcast of Valley Edition. Welcome back. I'm Juanita Stevenson, and you are listening to Valley Edition. The Sacramento-San Joaquin Delta is a critical part of the state for residents, farmers, and the environment. Over 23 million Californians rely on water from the Delta for their households. Thousands of acres of valley farmland also get their water from the Delta. And the region is also one of the most ecologically sensitive in the state, home to numerous species, including five that are threatened or endangered. For years, efforts to restore the health of the Delta have been mired in controversy and the courts. They have also largely failed to halt the decline of native fish populations and the overall health of the Delta ecosystem. Part of the reason is that until now, scientists didn't really know how the Delta really worked before modern levees, farms, and cities transformed the landscape. But thanks to a new study, that's changing. Valley Public Radio's Joe Moore has this report.
A new study just released by the San Francisco Estuary Institute and the California Department of Fish and Game aims to turn back the clock and learn how the Sacramento-San Joaquin Delta used to work over 150 years ago. It's part of an effort to allow scientists to better understand how to restore the delta by examining how the massive freshwater estuary functioned before the gold rush and agriculture transformed the region with levees, shipping channels, and dredging.
There was a general recognition that we didn't really know how it used to work, and that that would probably help us understand what native species really need and how we might go about reestablishing some of these features in the future.
That's Robin Grossinger, a senior scientist with the Institute who helped author the study. The task of analyzing the delta of 160 years ago wasn't easy. After all, there weren't satellite photos or GPS maps from the era to look back at. Instead, Grossinger says the team relied on a mix of old maps and drawings, vintage photographs, oral histories, and journals such as this one.
Maybe our biggest surprise and find was the extensive description, travel account of a guy who got lost in the marshes hunting ducks, and these guys had to spend the night and were hiking through the delta in the dark, trying to carry lots of ducks, and describing in detail everything they encountered, how deep the ponds that they had to wade through were.
The researchers took all of the information and put it into a computer program known as GIS, and slowly a picture of the old delta ecosystem began to emerge.
We were surprised ourselves to see how diverse and complex the landscape was. And then equally, it's also impressive then once you have that picture to see a lot of pieces that are still left or in some shape or form. There's maybe more remnants than one might realize, too.
Grossinger says that three distinct patterns emerged in their study of the region. In the north part of the delta along the Sacramento River, you would have once found broad, dense forest as much as half a mile wide. In the central delta, hundreds of miles of tidal channels used to flow through broad islands of tidal marshes, lakes, and willow fern swamps. The southern part of the delta was home to a more open landscape with grassy areas, floodplains, and wetlands. Grossinger says the effort will help guide future investments and research as the state works to improve the health of the delta.
It's not that we're going to reestablish the historical delta, and we wouldn't even want to, even if it was possible, because so many other things are going on there today. But as we're going to make strategic investments to improve the health of the ecosystem, it really does help to understand what native species need and how those kinds of habitats were created by natural processes.
While only 3% of the tidal wetlands that existed in the early 1800s exist in the delta today, Grossinger remains optimistic that with this new understanding of how the delta used to work, that future improvements are possible.
You know, these systems are not going to come back in their full scale ever. But that said, when you see how much has been lost, doing strategic, relatively small, but well-connected and well-designed projects could really make a big difference.
For Valley Public Radio, I'm Joe Moore.
And we thank Joel Moore for that report. Since it was enacted in 2004, California's Proposition 63 has raised over $8 billion by taxing the wealthy. The money was intended to pay for mental health services and prevention programs. But lawmakers have called for an audit after questions were raised about how money from the millionaires' tax is being spent. Health reporter Pauline Bartolone visited one program in Sacramento County.
Megan Stanton tried to kill herself once, but she shows no sign of depression today as she gives a tour of the Wellness and Recovery Center in North Sacramento.
This is the lobby. Down on that side, we have the medication support.
Stanton is executive director of the Consumer Self-Help Center, a program run by and for people with mental illness.
And then on this side, we have the wellness recovery.
The center provides traditional services such as medication management, but it also offers peer therapy and daily activities.
Does anybody have any words of encouragement from their life experience that might help reframe this?
Groups help people to deal with trauma, codependency, and anger. Others focus on nutrition, living with HIV, and even basic yoga.
Keep pressing, push out all the way down, push away, feel that tension in your shoulders, push, 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 push.
We're all really trying to provide something here that we thought might have been helpful to us when we were on the receiving end of services.
Funding yoga for mental health is one part of the act that has raised eyebrows. Lawmakers called for an audit over concerns that money was being spent on people without mental illness. But Megan Stanton says most of the people who walk through their doors have a diagnosis, and yoga can draw people into other activities that lead to recovery. Thousands of clients have come through the center over the years. Linda Cie is one of them.
In 1986, I was diagnosed with untreatable medication-resistant schizophrenia, and that I would be institutionalized. Which for quite some time that seemed like it was going to happen.
CA's favorite class is called Writing as a Path to Healing. She says she's learning to write to move past traumatic events, not to recount them. CA says she's taking a quarter of the medication she was on when she first got here.
The changes I've made in myself are just tremendous in just the few months that I've been here. And it's because of the groups. You know, the medication is only a small portion of it.
Megan Stanton says years ago, the Consumer Self-Help Center was much smaller and was little more than a drop-in center. She says the Mental Health Services Act provided an opportunity to ask clients about what services they wanted.
You know, what is wellness recovery and what does it look like? And what should we be including and how should we be going about providing those services?
But the part of Prop 63 most under scrutiny are the programs under the umbrella of prevention.
When you're growing any large new flower garden, there's going to be some weeds. And no one is saying that every single dollar is spent perfectly.
Rusty Seelix co-authored the act and now directs two California mental health organizations. He thinks the money is going towards what the law intended. Helping take the severely mentally ill off the streets, closing gaps in children's services, and paying for prevention. But he says mental health services have a long way to go.
To the extent that there's frustration, it's mostly due to the economy, that we have not made nearly the progress we thought we would have made by now in reducing the unmet need for mental health care. And that's due to the fact that the foundation upon which we were trying to build Prop 63 has crumbled.
Seelix supports the audit of the act he helped write. He says an audit could help eliminate wasteful bureaucracy and spotlight county-by-county variations in spending. But he stands by the non-traditional mental health care that he says could help people manage their lives.
These other forms of activities do have therapeutic value, and in the right manner, at the right cost, they can be a cost-effective strategy.
The Consumer Self-Help Center hasn't measured the success of its programs. Over the coming months, the state audit will provide its own evaluation of similar programs around the state. In Sacramento, I'm Pauline Bartolone.
Later this evening in Fresno, the sounds of one of the world's most famous vocal groups will fill the Paul Chagoyan Concert Hall as the group known as Shot Nuclear performs. A few days ago, FM89's Joe Moore talked with the group's director to learn more about tonight's performance.
For over three decades, the group Chanticleer has brought worldwide audiences a unique blend of music ranging from medieval to pop to original choral works. The San Francisco-based ensemble has become recognized as one of the premier male choral ensembles in the world and visits Fresno for a concert at the Paul Chagoyan Concert Hall on Tuesday, September 18th, presented by the Fresno Community Chorus. Interim Music Director Jace Wittig joins us now to talk about the group's new 35th anniversary tour, The Siren's Call, and more. Jace, welcome to Valley Public Radio.
Thank you very much for having me.
Jace, you're the interim music director with the ensemble. It's your seventh year, 35 years of reputation of excellence throughout the world. That has to be a lot of weight to carry on your shoulders. What's it like in this position as interim music director with this world-renowned choral ensemble?
Well, when you put it like that, yes, it is a little daunting. But, you know, I think we're very fortunate to have the reputation that we do. You know, the early members of this ensemble created something that has really had amazing staying power. And luckily, one of the things that has come of that is that we have very talented singers who audition for us. So to answer your question a little bit more directly, it's wonderful. You know, I feel very fortunate to work with these singers and to have very few limitations. And every day I come to work, I'm happy to work with them and to hopefully continue the legacy and, if I dare say, enrich it as well.
Chanticleer is one of the few choral groups that you could call a household name. What's it like to share this music with a wider audience?
It's wonderful. You know, we go everywhere from Paris, New York, to small towns, you know, that you may never have heard of in the middle of the country. Big audiences, small audiences, and each night is a challenge and also a wonderful experience. So it's one of the greatest things that we are able to do is to take our music all over the world.
The group has been called the world's reigning male chorus by The New Yorker and was named Ensemble of the Year by Musical America in 2008. This new tour, Siren Call, tell us about this new project.
Sure. Well, like any touring program that we take across the country, some of these audiences don't get to see us very often, so we try to portray to include all of the music, the different kinds of music that we do. Chanticleer was founded to explore early music, music of the Renaissance in particular, so there certainly is plenty of that with composers like Gabrielli and Palestrina, Gesualdo and his infamously chromatic kind of frenetic madrigals. But over the years, Chanticleer has also developed its repertoire to go much further beyond just early music. So we also have some 20th century music. We have three men's choruses from the sort of late Romantic years. And then we go all the way through pieces that were written just this summer, specifically for us by two of our composers, I guess is the way to say it. Chen Yi, a Chinese-American composer who lives in Kansas City, and Michael McGlynn, who is an Irish composer who has worked with us a lot. So we have two brand new pieces by them, as well as our sort of signature blend of folk music and pop and gospel as well to sort of round out the program. The title, The Siren's Call, was our jumping off point of inspiration. The sirens, of course, being born of Greek myth and portrayed in the Odyssey as beautiful women with honey-dripping voices who lure sailors toward their beautiful songs because they're so overpowering, often to the sailors' deaths, but not all of the music on the program is quite that dark. We chose to focus on the idea of desire and the human impulse to chase that which captures our hearts. So there are some stories taken directly from mythology, but it's a bit more of a global perspective on the idea of desire.
If you just joined us on Valley Public Radio today, Jace Wittig, the interim music director with Chanticleer, joins us on the phone today. The ensemble will be performing Tuesday evening at 7:30 at the Paul Chagoyan Concert Hall in Fresno. Jace, it has to be challenging as music director, or maybe you can correct me if I'm wrong, but is it not challenging for an ensemble to tackle brand new commission works and also ancient music and everything in between? Is that the breadth of the material that Chanticleer covers, does that make it more difficult for you and the members of the ensemble?
I think it might make it more difficult for the members of the ensemble than for me. but I did sing in the ensemble, so I try to keep that in mind. But to be honest with you, it's one of the things that makes us unique in the world of choral music. Generally speaking, people tend to focus on one or two things that they do well, and we certainly respect that, but we try to do all of them, or at least a large variety of them. And for the singers, yes, it's a challenge at first, but it also makes it exciting, you know, that you get to not only sing Renaissance or not only sing 20th century music, but that you get to do all of them, and that's one of the luxuries of being in Chanticleer.
Do you think that perhaps too often in other ensembles, other branches of classical music, that perhaps the boundaries might be a little too arbitrary or too artificial in some way? Is this a good thing that Chanticleer is able to cross over and break through some of these boundaries that other ensembles perhaps stay within?
Sure. I mean, I think every ensemble has its place. And, you know, we have just had the good fortune of being in the position to break those boundaries. I think partly because of the history of the ensemble and our broad touring schedule, you know, we're able to bring a little bit of everything to everybody. No, I don't think that other ensembles are lacking anything. It's just, as I said, this is our fortunate position, and we're glad to have it.
Tell us a little more about the history of the group and how it came about. You alluded to it earlier in our conversation, but exactly how did Chanticleer come together originally, and how has it managed to maintain its vitality for 35 years and to have such appeal with audiences worldwide?
Sure. Well, Chanticleer was founded in 1978. This is actually our 35th anniversary season, as I think you said earlier, but more on that later. Chanticleer was founded in 1978 by a man named Louis Botto, who was living here in San Francisco. And this was just sort of where the early music scene was kind of picking up steam. And Louis was a scholar of early music and knew a lot about performance practice, how the music was performed when it was written. And he knew that a lot of the Renaissance choral music that was written for the church was written only to be sung by men, meaning that the soprano and the alto parts were sung by male sopranos and male altos. And he wasn't hearing a lot of that being performed. And he said, well, I have this immense pile of music, and I have friends who can sing it. So he literally got together a group of his friends, friends from the opera chorus and from Grace Cathedral here in San Francisco, a very well-known church with a good choral tradition, and friends from the symphony chorus, and cooked them a meal and said, let's rehearse this and see what comes of it. And they turns out they liked it. And eventually a concert was scheduled in Old Mission Dolores here in the city. And good fortune would have it that an agent was in the audience that night and approached the singers after the concert and said, I want to put this on the road. This is great. So they began to tour California. Then, as you would say, the rest is history. Tours were scheduled around the United States, abroad, and even within the very few early years of the ensemble, they were already touring internationally. And the ensemble became a full-time paid, singing in the ensemble became a full-time paid position right around the year 1990, and has been so ever since then.
And the name Chanticleer, I understand, goes back to Chaucer.
That's right, the clear singing rooster. And even the word Chanticleer itself, chant from the French chant, to sing, and clair, to sing clearly. So that's where we took our name.
This tour features the premiere performances of two works. Just briefly tell us about those.
Sure.
Brand new music.
That's right. That's right. And that is something that was very important to our longtime music director. Now our music director emeritus, Joseph Jennings, was the creation of new material to add to the choral repertoire. And two composers that we've had long relationships with are Chen Yi, who is really a mastermind of a composer and has a language that is instantly recognizable. She's a Chinese-American composer. And she wrote a piece for us called I Hear the Sirens Call, which is a very programmatic piece in that it tells a specific story. You hear a siren song, this sort of haunting and almost wild sounding siren song sung by our highest sopranos in this sort of Chinese mode. And then you hear voices of the sailors kind of singing a work song below them. And the sailors gradually build up and are drawn toward the siren song until you hear a very dramatic and very very recognizable shipwreck, after which the siren kind of sings this satisfied melody and the whispers of the sailors echo on the rocks. After that, we go into the other piece you were talking about by Michael McGlynn. He is a wonderful composer from Ireland who has a group over there called Anuna. And he's written for us on several occasions in the past. We've recorded several of his pieces as well. He has, it's sort of a two-part work. The first part is called Aura na Gwiha. It's sung in Latin and in Irish, and it literally means Song of the Wind. So it's inspired by the sounds of the wind blowing on the rugged Irish coast. And then the second part is Hinbara, which is also sort of a nonsense word in Irish, but it's a sort of a celebration of the lives of Irish fishermen.
Our guest today has been Jace Wittig. He is the interim music director for the ensemble Chanticleer, one of the world's premier male choral groups, and they're performing Tuesday, September 18th, at the Paul Chagoyan Concert Hall in Fresno, presented by the Fresno Community Chorus. Jace, thank you so much for taking the time to join us today.
Absolutely. It's been my pleasure.
You're listening to Valley Public Radio.
And you are listening to Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio. I'm Renita Stevenson. We'll be back in just a moment for an interview with local photographer Joel Pickford. We'll talk about his new book of photography called Soul Calling, which took him around the valley and around the world, documenting the rich culture and traditions of the Hmong people. That's coming up next on Valley Edition. You're listening to a rebroadcast of Valley Edition. Welcome back. I'm Juanita Stevenson, and you're listening to Valley Edition. His pictures are captivating. His films and words go to the heart of the story. Award-winning photographer, filmmaker, and author Joel Pickford is about to showcase his latest work, pictures from his book, Soul Calling, Photographic Journey Through the Hmong Diaspora. On September 28th, the Fresno Art Museum will premiere a major exhibition based on the book. And we are pleased to have Joel Pickford with us today. Thanks for coming in today.
Nice to be here, Juanita.
I must say, I took a look at the book, and I just really loved the pictures. They really tell the story. How long did you work on this book?
I think the book represents about 7 years of photography, both here in the valley and done on six trips to Laos.
Six trips. Tell us a little bit about those trips and what you saw. Did you see changes over the years each time you went?
I saw a tremendous amount of change. Laos is a country that's developing at a breakneck pace. Being a single-party, non-elected government, they can simply decide to move ahead with anything they want, and that's not always a good thing. A lot of outside interests are coming in, China, Vietnam, Australia, European countries, building projects to serve their own interests. But as far as the Hmong are concerned, you know, you're seeing a lot of changes. Like in the first years, I photographed the villages with those beautiful thatched roofs. Now more and more of those villages have brick houses and tin roofs, and now electric wires stretch over the roads that I originally traveled that didn't have any.
Wow. Why did you choose to document the Hmong immigrants? Why did you choose that as your topic for this book?
I was originally recruited to do it by a social worker who was working with a local organization called FIRM that served the refugee community. And they were specifically interested in having me photograph the new arrivals who came between 2004 and 2006 and to focus on the housing issues that they faced.
Oh, that's really something. When you take a look in your book at the housing situation that many of them lived in when they first came here. And what I really liked is the way you could compare it to, you know, their villages in Laos as compared to these slums that they were basically, they basically lived here in the Central Valley. And in a way, you almost feel like they've fared better just in their own environment. Why did you want to take a look at that, the housing situation?
Well, there were a lot of issues. You know, there were landlords that were taking advantage of them of the Hmong, charging them for things that they didn't actually owe. There were really bad conditions. Repairs and maintenance weren't being done. I actually visited one apartment where there was a gaping hole in the roof. And so I learned about the amazing story of the Hovhannessian family, who came as refugees of the Armenian
genocide.
Exactly.
They came here as refugees themselves,
right,
in a way. And then in a way they were exploiting refugees.
Yeah, and Kaspar, like many early Hmong immigrants, he had an arranged marriage. He only met his bride on his wedding day. And he started out working in the fields and working as a farmer. But ultimately, over three generations, the family built up an empire of rental property in the valley to where they finally owned as many as 4,000 units, all free and clear, all low-income, deteriorating kind of rental properties.
And they put absolutely no work into those properties whatsoever.
And that was the issue that was documented in a lot of articles in the Fresno Bee. But the Bee never told the big picture story, so I was really excited to do that as one chapter of the book.
Right. That was very interesting to me. And, you know, when I took a look at the pictures in the book and you look at the faces of the new arrivals, just, you know, as they arrive here, and they do seem to just look lost.
Mm-hmm. It's important to understand that the new arrivals who came between 2004 and 2006 are basically the bottom of the heap in the Hmong socioeconomic order. These are the people who were among the last to escape from Laos, among the last to find sponsors to come to the United States. And, you know, their gaunt frames really reflect the pervasive malnutrition in the camps.
And, you know, just like the title of your book, A Diaspora, I admit I looked up the word, and, you know, and part of it means to be dispersed, and they were lifted up out of their homeland. They were dispersed all across the country, some here in the Central Valley, some in the Midwest, and you just feel like they were kind of, you know, they were refugees, and they, you know, had to leave their homeland, but it just seemed like they were placed anywhere.
Yes, and I think they were in a kind of culture shock. You know, I encountered them in their first days here, and here they were surrounded by these empty white walls that they'd never seen, in some cases the colder weather than they'd ever imagined. And they were just kind of some of the refugees were very kind of discouraged and withdrawn. They didn't, you know, suddenly they're in a whole new world where you owe all these bills for things like electricity and rent that they weren't used to owing, and you can't get anywhere unless one of your relatives comes and picks you up in a car. And so they were just in this very disoriented state. Now, I saw some families that prospered immediately, like the family of Chachia Yang, who's a Kang master. Within just a few months, all of the adult males in his family had jobs, despite speaking very little English, and he was very respected in the Hmong community and earned a good income as a Kang player, both making and selling the Kangs, teaching others to play them, and performing at funerals, which is a very important thing in the culture.
And really, some of the Hmong people, some of the Hmong refugees who came here, and that was one of the things I remember about, you know, reporting on the new arrivals, is that the ones who had relatives here, and the fact that this group also, in a way, even though they seemed to be lost here, they also benefited from the fact that there was a first wave of Hmong immigrants, people who could kind of help show them the way, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. I think the Hmong, more than any other immigrant group in the United States, really knows how to work together and to stick together and to benefit from well-organized kind of unified support for one another.
What do you see from, you say you know, this was about a six-year undertaking. Some of those new arrivals, do you have knowledge of what's happened in their lives since then?
Yes, as a matter of fact, I've gone to visit them. I had a favorite apartment complex that I write about in the book. It was in central Fresno. And, you know, despite the fact it was owned by the Hovhannessian family, and despite the fact that it was run down and had all of these bad conditions, I have really very happy memories of that place, because these people were so warm in receiving me and allowing me to come into their lives and to photograph. In fact, throughout this project, both in California and Laos, I found the Hmong people incredibly hospitable and welcoming, and a lot of the photographs I made were a result of Hmong people calling me up and inviting me to a shaman ceremony or to a funeral. You can't just walk around and hope you're going to stumble into
something like that.
So, you know, they were, you know, I've been asked many times, you know, Joel, how do you go into these cultures all over the world and get inside and make such intimate photographs? And the answer is, when you show people that you are genuinely interested in learning about their culture, and they know if it's genuine or whether there's an agenda.
No, they really do.
They will take you by the hand and lead you places you never thought you would go. And it's just been an incredible experience. I've learned the Lao language in the process. I've gained a Hmong family here in Fresno, the Lee family. I've gained a Lao family in Laos, the Kevik Pongsai family. So of all of the projects I've ever done, this is the most personally enriching for me.
I know you. I've looked at some of your other work, like the work you did in Louisiana and other parts of the country. Do you think a part of when you talk about the way you identify and feel toward the Hmong people is that you know they're here now in your region, and you've been able to just really watch and document the transition in their lives?
You know, it's funny. For a long time, I thought, you know, just from driving past some of the apartment complex for years before doing the project, I thought, man, that's got to be really interesting. Maybe I should do something. So when the invitation came along from Firm, I jumped at the chance. And as soon as I'd been doing it just for days, I immediately wanted to expand the project beyond just new arrivals and look at the people that had already been here for up to 30 years, and to travel to Laos and really to try to search out the roots of the culture.
And that's what's fascinating, you know, about this book, and I'm sure what we're going to see in the exhibit is the fact that there is now a history, something you can document from the first wave of Hmong refugees to the Central Valley, and then the second wave. And now they have been here in the valley long enough that you see another generation, you know, of Hmong who are prospering. But then again, you have those who are still, you know, living in the slums. But, you know, you could say that about any group. You know, there's a top, middle, and bottom.
Mm-hmm. And actually, the Hmong are moving up really fast. Among immigrant groups, they're one of the fastest group. It's kind of a cultural thing that the parents really push education for the kids. You see the same thing in Laos, by the way. Hmong kids, though a minority in the classrooms, are often at the top of the class. And the same is true here in the valley, that the parents really push education. And some of the healthiest families I know who have done the best, they push education and success in the Western world, but they also teach Hmong language and culture. And that's true of my Hmong family, the Lee family.
Right. They still celebrate their culture. And you see that a lot in some of the events and activities that they have here in the Central Valley. Tell us a little bit about the exhibit and what we're going to see.
Okay. First of all, I'm really happy that the Art Museum and the Irvine Foundation gave me the opportunity to spend my whole summer making these very large, beautiful prints. I was printing for something like 7 weeks, 7 days a week. It reminded me why we have museums. You cannot really experience photographs until you see a print actually made by the photographer. Ansel Adams, who's also being shown simultaneously at the museum, used to talk about the negative being the score and the print being the performance. And I've always felt that way, that that taking a picture is only 50% of the art. The other 50% is the print that you craft to really bring out
and
the full potential.
And you do craft your prints.
I
mean, they don't just look like a print once you get through with them. I mean, we're talking, just beautiful artwork.
Yeah, they're done on a rag paper that comes from a mill in Germany that was milling paper when Shakespeare was writing his plays. And it's coated with a special coating that's similar to the black and white darkroom paper that Ansel Adams uses. But, you know, I myself didn't really fully know those images, despite working with the publisher and so on. I didn't really know the images until I made those prints. So it really reminded me why we have museums, so that you can go see original prints installed with special lighting and no distractions, and you know, as opposed to just putting everything online and staying home.
Now, this exhibit is going to premiere at the Fresno Art Museum starting on September 28th, correct?
Yes, uh-huh. And that's a special day. I think events start about 3, and there will be several talks about various shows like the Ansel Adams Show. I'll give my talk at 5 in the Bonner Auditorium. There's a lot to see, so I recommend that folks get there early. I also curated a show by Hmong artist Hua Vang, who's 70 years old, and she's a master of the pandao and story cloth art form. That's an art form, that the story cloth that was really born in the camps and is now dying out because it's not really practical for people to continue it. And so it's a way that the Hmong found of telling their own story. And so I'm very happy that in addition to showing my photographs and my view of the Hmong, that we were able to present the Hmong version of their own story in the form of Hua Vang's Pandao art.
Wow, this is really going to be a show. How long is it going to be?
I believe it's up through New Year's, because as you know, Hmong New Year is a very important part of the culture. And then it probably comes down in early January.
Okay. Taking a look at his book, I'd say that the Valley is really in for some great, great artwork and storytelling. Again, Joel Pickford's new exhibit at the Fresno Art Museum premieres on September 28th. And his book, Soul Calling, A Photographic Journey Through the Hmong Diaspora. Great book and great pictures. And thanks so much, Joel, for coming in this morning.
Thanks, Juanita.
And that is all for today's Valley Edition. You can hear audio archives and subscribe to our podcast online at kbpr.org. We welcome your comments and suggestions. You can email us at talk@kbpr.org. For studio engineer Marv Allen, production and operations manager Don Weaver, and executive producer Joe Moore, I'm Juanita Stevenson, and this is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation and the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians, on the web at chcf.org.